records to provide the FBI to assess the value of equipment that is worth no more than $200,000. Thank you. And if there are no other further questions, I would, this case to the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.
Case number 09-5402, Ed Brayton, appellant versus Office of the United States Trade Representative. Ms. Rosenbaum for appellant, Mr. Birch for appellee.
Rosenbaum, welcome.
Thank you. May it please the court, Adina Rosenbaum on behalf of appellant Ed Brayton, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In 2007, Congress amended FOIA's fee shifting provision to provide that a plaintiff may receive attorney's fees if the plaintiff has received relief through a voluntary or unilateral change in position by the government and the plaintiff's claim was not insubstantial. The district court below applied a different standard for determining whether plaintiff Ed Brayton could receive fees. It held that a plaintiff may not receive fees, even if his claim was not insubstantial, and even if he received relief through a voluntary or unilateral change in position by the government, if the government's position on the merits was correct. In other words, the district court held that for a plaintiff to be able to receive fees, his claim does not have to just be not insubstantial, as Congress provided. It has to actually be right.
No, that's not actually what the district court said, right? It's only if cases that are resolved as a matter of law, right? I mean, you could have a plaintiff who has not insubstantial arguments and loses, but doesn't lose as a matter of law, right? You have contested issues of fact that doesn't win on summary judgment, not as a matter of law, but still loses. So I don't think your characterization of what the district court said is quite accurate.
Well, in this case, the district court held as, or decided as a matter of law, that Brayton's claim, or that the defendant's claim was correct, and held that because of that, it as a matter of law did not have discretion to award Brayton fees.
Right. The district court's view is if it's clear as a matter of law that the plaintiff has no claim, then that's an instance in which he may not win attorney's fees. But I don't think it is accurate to say that the district court ruled out every instance in which a plaintiff who has not insubstantial arguments is awarded attorney's fees. That's just describing the district court too broadly.
The way that I read the district court's decision is that it held that a plaintiff may not receive fees if the court would have held that the defendant would have won in the case. And here again,
as a matter of law, that's right.
As a matter of law, and FOIA cases generally are decided as a matter of law. They're usually decided on summary judgment claims.
Not always, frequently.
Yes, frequently.
And there's another instance where the cases we're talking about, there's a mootness argument as well, right? Because the government has now disclosed the documents. Why couldn't you imagine a situation where the district court does not resolve the issue as a matter of law, but they resolve it because it's now been mooted? They haven't precluded the possibility for the plaintiff still to be awarded fees for a not insubstantial argument, even though they would have lost had it gone to a full determination.
Well, the way that I read the district court's decision is that it was holding that if the plaintiff would have lost, that in all of those cases they would not have been awarded fees. I don't read the district court to have been making a determination between what grounds they would have lost on.
Isn't that true pre-Buckhannon, that if the government's position was correct, then you don't get the fees?
Yes, that was true pre-Buckhannon, but the standard in the Open Government Act
is what's a little unusual, going to the larger picture of what happened here, that the Congress was intending to restore the pre-Buckhannon law, and I think your position would be broader than pre-Buckhannon law.
Under pre-Buchanan law, it was true that if the defendant's position was correct, that was dispositive. But in the Open Government Act, Congress did not just return the law to the way it was before Buchanan. Under the prior version of FOIA, in determining whether a plaintiff had substantially prevailed, the court did not look at all at the merits of the plaintiff's claim. It was merely a matter of causation. The court looked at whether the lawsuit had been reasonably necessary and had substantially caused the requested records to be released. But in amending the statute, Congress didn't just say that now plaintiffs could receive fees if they received relief through a voluntary unilateral change in position by the government. It also added this part, and if the claim was not insubstantial. So it added a section. It gave thought to how meritorious the plaintiff's claim had to be in order for the plaintiff to be able to receive fees, and where it drew the line was at not insubstantial, not under correct, which was essentially the standard under the pre-Buchanan law.
Did the district court in this case make a determination that your client's claim was not insubstantial?
The court did not address that issue.
Well, you started out as if to suggest that that was a given. It's not a given in this case.
That was not addressed by the district court, and the defendant has not argued in this case that Braden's claim was not insubstantial. The standard not insubstantial.
I don't know whether they're doing it directly or not, but one way to look at it is insubstantial if the law foreclosed what the plaintiff was seeking. It's not a substantial claim, if as a matter of law, not as a matter of a factual battle where it isn't entirely clear how it will come out, but as a matter of law, this is not possible. Is that a substantial claim?
The test for substantiality is whether a claim is clearly non-meritorious on its face. That's in the legislative history. Senator Kyle talked about that. It's the standard that's used for how strong a federal claim has to be in order for there to be supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claims. From the legislative history, it is clear that that's the standard that they meant to be adopting in this case.
It's a curious question here. Does the law intend to knock off Chesapeake? And if we do, then there's an interesting policy question. Wouldn't the government have every incentive in these cases to then just go ahead and try them? We're not going to settle with you. Because we're going to win it. As a matter of law, we'll try it. You're not going to get fees. That's why I'm saying, would anyone assume that this was going to be, would you get fees after that loss? No.
The government may not know or will not know
about in the cases in which the law is clear. I understand there's some cases where that's not, and I'm not, that doesn't seem to be the case here. This seems to be one of those odd cases where it's pretty clean picture, that is, the law is clear, you lose if you keep going. If you had to try this case, you're going to lose it on the law. No one's going to say your position was substantial. The government's not going to pay fees. And then if we rule as you do in future cases, the government has an incentive to say, well, we'll just go to file summary judgment. Take it all the way. We're not going to pay the fees.
Well, Congress did set a standard that below which a plaintiff cannot receive fees, and that is the not insubstantial
claim. Well, but that's what I'm
saying.
We're going around in circles. I don't think that anyone is going to suggest that your position would be substantial if the government is going to win as a matter of law, and that's just not debatable. And so they're not going to moot it out. They're going to file motion for summary judgment, let it finish up to avoid the fees.
Well, I think there are a lot of cases where it is debatable whether or not the government will win as a matter of law.
That might be different. I mean, the one thing that concerns me about this case is, and I'm going to ask both sides this, it seems to me the district court felt that it had no discretion. If, having thought about it a lot, it decided, well, the government probably was going to win as a matter of law, and that's that. That doesn't seem to fit squarely with the law. So now you've taken it to that area with what you just said. That is, let's assume we have a case where the government might win as a matter of law if we struggled really hard. They might. but they decide to moot it out because it isn't entirely clear which way it's going to go. You're suggesting the district court surely must have discretion in that case under this law to grant fees.
Yes, the statute says that if a claim is not insubstantial, the district court may assess fees.
Okay, so now that goes to how we would write it. It doesn't answer the question, what do we do in a case like this where it appears indisputable that the government wins as a matter of law? But they decide, oh, the heck with it, we'll just stop now. But they're going to win it. And no one can doubt they're going to win it.
Well, I think in this case it was not indisputable that
really?
The government would have won as a matter of law. That's an issue that
why
the
do you
court
say that?
Below
because it's
determined
favorable
that.
Favorable to your side, or in fact,
well,
why do you think that?
Our argument below was a substantial argument about whether Exemption 1 exempted the materials at issue here, whether they had been properly classified, and it turned on a dispute over the meaning of some WTO rules and what exactly they required to be kept secret, where the government argued that once that these rules required these records submitted to the WTO to be kept secret, and our argument was that the rules only required the WTO copies of the document to be secret and did not mean that the submitting country actually had to keep the records secret themselves. And I think there was a real dispute over the meaning of those WTO documents and what exactly the WTO rules meant for the United States' obligation either to keep those records secret or to release them because they were not properly classified under FOIA.
So let's say you end up with the situation, the district court hears all of this, and you say, but we presented a good legal argument. The district court said, I've thought about it, and now in the context of your request for fees, and I don't think it was a substantial argument. I think the argument as a matter of law was a loser from the get-go. And I hear it, you read it, I can't penalize you for it, no sanctions, but as a matter of fact, the government wins and wins cold. Wouldn't you agree in that situation, pursuant to the discretion the statute gives, the court could say, you lose?
If the district court holds that the claim was not insubstantial, which is the standard in the statute, they actually don't have discretion to award fees in that circumstance. But the standard of not insubstantial is not the same thing as correct as a matter of law. Something that Senator Kyl pointed out on the Senate floor in introducing the not insubstantial language was that part of what was useful about it was that it was a standard that could be determined at the outset.
Is there a space between insubstantial and sanctionable?
I think there might be some space between there, but I think that not insubstantial.
So then the district court could say what you propose was insubstantial, not sanctionable, insubstantial, and it was insubstantial because it was a cold loser as a matter of law.
That's a determination, though, that would have to be made. It would have to be very clear on the face of the complaint that it was a loser as a matter of law, and that's not something
very clear as a matter of precedent that the district court went and read and said, I saw what you asked for. I went and read the cases in the statute. Your argument's insubstantial. Not sanctionable, but insubstantial. That's why I was curious. Were you suggesting that insubstantial is at a level of sanctionable? I didn't think you were, so you're saying there's some space.
I'm saying that there is some space, but that there's also a large space between not insubstantial or between insubstantial
and
correct.
I understand that. I mean, you want that to be big. I understand what you're doing there, but I don't know. It just seems to me you can have a case where a district court might properly say, exercising the discretion I think that the statute requires, that, you know, I've read what you said and you could not have won this.
The district court could decide that a case was not insubstantial. That's not what the district court held here. It was assuming that the case was not insubstantial, yet nonetheless it held that it did not have the discretion
where
to award fees.
Where did the district court assume it was not insubstantial? You keep saying that, and I'm not sure where that is.
Oh, it did not specifically state that, but it went on to determining entitlement without addressing substantially prevailed.
Yeah, no, I mean, but that's a critical question in my mind. District court said nothing about that.
About
the insubstantiality.
It did not address
the insubstantiality.
It just
jumped on Chesapeake and said, if I find it's a loser as a matter of law, that's the end of it. So now you and I are now talking about how do we fit insubstantial in there. District court said nothing about that, though.
The district court did not address substantiality, but It did hold that once a plaintiff had substantially prevailed, the standard in the statute, that if it would have found that the defendant's claim was correct, that it did not have discretion to award fees. And what the statute says is that in that circumstance, the court does have the discretion to award fees. And
you still agree that the four-factor test applies, right?
We still agree that the court has discretion to award fees, and the four factors is what the court has traditionally looked at.
And the fourth factor is the reasonableness of the agency's position.
Right? Yes.
And you still agree that that's part of the calculus?
Yes, I agree that that's still part of the calculus. It on its own cannot
be dispositive. And interpreting that factor before, in our precedents before Buckhannon, we said that we're going to look at the reasonableness of the agency's position, and if the agency's position was correct, that will be the dispositive factor.
Yes, but post-Buchanan, the new version of the statute, now Congress
so it's not the same four-factor test that we had before then.
The court can still look at all equitable considerations.
Well, we have to alter how we applied the test from how we applied it before is what you're saying.
Yes, it has to be altered from how it was applied when the defendant's position was correct on the merits. Mm-hmm. But that is still one of the considerations that can be looked at and balanced among the other factors.
How are you going to balance that, though? I don't understand that. You're balancing the public benefit, whether there's a commercial interest. So usually if it's a public interest organization with a public benefit that could be derived from disclosure, that clears the first few factors of the balance, and then you go to the fourth one. How does that work if you say, okay, well, those things lead toward fees, but the fourth factor, the agency was reasonable in its position, so therefore not going to award fees?
I think it would
How's that different from what's going on here?
Well, here, I think it would depend on whether the court was addressing it in a way where it did not, where it would always come out that the court would award fees. And if that's the case, that's the same as having a categorical rule that the defendant's position on the merits is dispositive. But again, Congress said where it wanted the line to be of how meritorious a plaintiff's claim had to be in order for the plaintiff to be able to be awarded
Congress
fees.
Congress really didn't, because the word may is still a problem. And that's true in a lot of attorney's fee statutes, so it's not unique to this case, of course. If it wanted to really draw the line, it would say shall, as it has in a few attorney's fees statutes. But the may leaves discretion, and then the reasonableness of the agency's position comes in. And we had balanced that before, saying, well, if it's correct, that's going to be a trump in the balance. And I'm trying to figure out how the fourth factor will stay in the game, but still how to alter it in your direction.
In fact, isn't the better reading of the statute that it just amended the eligibility prong? It really didn't go to entitlement.
Well, this court has distinguished between eligibility and entitlement, but a factor in the entitlement step can't negate the words of the statute. And here, if the plaintiff's position on the merits is dispositive of entitlement,
What the statute did was corrected Buchanan and said, you're eligible if the government gives you the documents. We don't need to have a court order. You're now eligible. Now, when we look to entitlement, we go back to the four-factor test, which says one of the things to look at is, was the government's position reasonable? Isn't that a better reading of the history here?
That is still one of the things to look at, but Congress also gave thought to exactly where, how strong it wanted the plaintiff's claim to be in order for the plaintiff to be categorically foreclosed from being able to receive fees. And it set that line at not insubstantial. And requiring it to actually be correct,
that gets you eligible, it doesn't get you entitlement. What Congress was saying is, before, you know, after Buchanan, you weren't eligible. Now we're fixing it. You're eligible. You're back in the pool, but you've got to survive the entitlement test. And yeah.
It's meaningless, though, to say that a plaintiff is eligible to receive fees if there's no set of circumstances under which that plaintiff will receive fees. And so, if a plaintiff whose claim is not insubstantial,
the only time you don't receive it is a matter of law. You don't receive it.
Well, it's if as a matter of law your claim
that's right,
you would
you don't
have lost.
Get it. Yeah, you don't get it.
But then there's plaintiffs whose claims were not insubstantial but also not correct. This category of plaintiffs where the statute specifically says that those plaintiffs may receive fees, and yet what What the district court held is that those plaintiffs may not receive fees.
That's where I get lost, because in that space that you're talking about, the may receive fees, you still have the fourth factor in there. And I'm just trying to figure out how a district court's supposed to do that.
Well, district courts have balanced that factor without viewing it as dispositive in the past. When the defendant's claim was not correct, that is still a factor that's looked at, is the reasonableness of the defendant's position. And yet it's not dispositive. It's just one of a number of considerations weighed, including the other three entitlement factors that the court has.
So you're not arguing that the fourth factor is out?
No, it's still something that can be looked to. It's just on its own can't be dispositive. Here, the district court didn't look at any of the other factors, such as the public interest in release of the document at issue in this case.
Ms. Rosenbaum, we've taken more of your time, so we'll give you a minute back if you hear something that the government says that you want to reply to directly. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Morning, Mr. Birch.
Good morning. May it please the court. The core of this case is really whether the Open Government Act worked a change on the fourth factor, and the from this court's precedent, and the starting place is clearly the statute.
The fourth factor.
The fourth factor, and the starting place for that analysis has to be the statutory language, and it is clear that the statutory language on the Open Government Act worked a change on the definition of substantially prevailed. That is the eligibility prong, and it left in place the entitlement analysis, which clearly, as Judge Kavanaugh identified, it hinges on the word may and this court's precedent interpreting how that discretion in using the word may is to be employed. And the four factors, including the fourth factor at issue here, have been on the books for many years before Buchanan came down. And the notion that the change to the substantially prevailed language would have a backdoor effect is simply unsupported in the way the statute operates, and it would also, if that theory were to be accepted, as Judge Kavanaugh identified, it would suggest that there had been a problem all along in the way that this court had set up the fourth factor, because the fourth factor, when it becomes dispositive, necessarily limits the district court's discretion that would be available if this court were looking purely at the statute and ignored case law. Case law from an appellate court is permitted to withdraw certain areas of the statutory construct that is potentially available, and the district courts are bound to honor that precedent.
Now, what is your understanding of what Chesapeake and thus the district court means to say with respect to that as a matter of law factor? Is that, I look at it, there isn't any doubt in my mind. I look at it and, you know, if you make me struggle hard now and think really hard about it, I guess I probably would have gone with the government, but it's close. Cover that too? As opposed to, I look at it and I think the government was wrong. So are you saying the rule has to be the government has to be wrong as a matter of law in order for fees to be possible?
I would think that wrong as a matter of law may be different than right as a matter of law.
Well, that's what I want to hear, how you're playing that out.
Well, the wrong as a matter of law, I don't think the court would ever need to reach, and that's never been a part of the precedent. If the government were right as a matter of law, as it was here, then that triggers
how right do you have to be?
I would submit that a summary judgment analysis would be appropriate. That seems to be what the district court was going on. It didn't set out a standard of review in its opinion, so it didn't make it explicit that that's what it was doing, but certainly the analysis reads that way, and it does conclude at the very end of its opinion that it's going on as a matter of law.
Isn't it a binary choice? Right.
Whether the government is correct as a matter of law,
yes,
or
right or wrong as a matter of law, and you're going to have to figure that out. And if the government's right as a matter of law,
well, with the summary judgment analysis, it's either right as a matter of law or the case continues.
But that doesn't happen in FOIA cases.
Not very often, no. But it's also possible that the government wouldn't take the position that it was correct as a matter of law in opposing the fee petition. It might simply argue that it was had a reasonable position. And in that, so
it's the cases of first impression. It's the long, hard. I mean, I can think of a lot of FOIA cases where someone was
declared right as a matter of law, but the court agonized like crazy to get there, and there was nothing easy about it. Now, what are you saying about those cases? As opposed to a case that, you know, you can look at it, you look at the law, and you work a little bit, but it's pretty clear what the result's going to be as a matter of law. They're all in the same pool?
Well, it's somewhat of a fuzzy distinction. I mean, some of the cases on summary judgment can be very difficult.
Know that I agree with the summary judgment, because the district court likes to do everything by summary judgment, so I don't know what that tells us. That's district courts don't want to try anything, so that's if they can avoid a jury trial. So I don't know what that gets me.
Well, this case is a difficult one to get at that, Your Honor, because I don't understand. It's
well, difficult. Trying to think. We have to write it. You know, it's clean here. It's a new issue. We have to say something. I'm curious to know what the government's view is. Is it, as Judge Kavanaugh just suggested, a binary question? No matter how hard you had to work, if the end answer is government wins as a matter of law, whether it's a case of first impression or whatever, that's it. Is that what your position is?
Consistent with the summary judgment analysis, I would think that would be the position that we would take. That's consistent with the case law. To the extent that it's an open question, I don't think this case is the one that you need to resolve that on, because the government's case was very clear. There are very little facts that are in dispute.
Isn't this going to lead to lots of satellite litigation in a case where an agency turns over the document? There's going to have to be a lot of litigation to figure out, as Judge Edwards points out, was the government right or wrong? And that's going to be potentially a long, drawn-out litigation process that's really...
I don't understand how this case would have the potential to change that to the extent that it already exists under the case.
Well, because if it's just a four-factor test, and you don't have to actually figure out who would have won the case in determining the fee award. You're just looking at the reasonableness of the agency's position as one factor in the balance.
Right. That's always been the law. And so this case doesn't have the potential to make that any worse in terms of how you would write it or the standard of how correct does the government have to be.
Your point is it just returns the law to where it was.
With respect to the eligibility prong, I thought we were talking about entitlement.
No, you're talking about entitlement.
Yeah.
On the four-factor test, your position is that the four-factor test is still applied, and Chesapeake, which held that on the fourth factor, if the government's position is correct, that ends it.
Right. Right. That's our position, that the Open Government Act did not change that. Mm-hmm. That's still good law. There's nothing in the statutory text that would suggest that Congress did roll back Chesapeake or with respect to the fourth factor or any other aspect of the entitlement analysis, nor is there anything in the legislative history that supports that either. Right?
Well, yeah, I mean, your core argument is you're splitting eligibility and entitlement and saying this: we don't have to think anything about entitlement because Congress didn't do anything there, so the only thing you have to clarify is eligibility.
Well,
is that what you're? I'm trying to get it straight.
That's the split. Yes, we agree with. I think the easier way to resolve this case is just the way the district court did, by affirming its reasoning and outcome on entitlement. But certainly, we agree that there is a split in the analysis as there always has been between eligibility and entitlement, and that the Open Government Act did nothing to roll that back. That's the core of our position. If there are no other questions, I'm happy to ask that the court affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Ms. Rosenbaum, did you hear something in there that you need to reply to? We'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you. I do want to reply to one thing about the legislative history, which is that the government's position is contrary to the understanding of the senator who introduced the not insubstantial language, who said on the Senate floor that the that under the standard that he was introducing, that there would be times when the government would have to award fees even though its position on the merits had not been correct. And also in terms of splitting the steps into eligibility and entitlement, although that's the way it has been approached, the entitlement factor
The government would have to award fees even in situations when its position
on the law was incorrect?
It said the...
Is that what I heard you say? Maybe I misheard you.
Yes. Senator Kyle said that the not insubstantial language is a pretty low standard, and that it would allow the requester to be deemed a prevailing party even if the government's arguments were meritorious and the government would have won the case had the case been litigated to a judgment.
What you said on meritorious. Okay, I'm sorry.
So even if they would have won had the case been litigated to a judgment. And he then repeats that, of course, the four factor test would still apply, but that the fourth factor is not dispositive.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenbaum. I think we have your argument.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.